Hello, and welcome to Covered, a conversation about books with the people who write them. I'm your host, Harry Marks, and today's guest is the owner of CW Pencil Enterprise in New York City, a boutique pencil shop that has taken off as part of a resurgence of analog appreciation in our digital world. However, she is here today to discuss her new book from Gestalten, The Pencil Perfect, which tells the tumultuous history of the ubiquitous object and how it has influenced our lives. Caroline Weaver. Caroline, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
The pencil, as I've been reading, is not an easy thing to make, and over 200 years required ingenuity, different kinds of technology, teams of people, and yet, when we think about it, it is about as mass market as you can get. And yet, it seems to me to be more romanticized than pens and other stationery. In your book, you have this passage in the preface: "With a pencil, one can experience an intimacy that can't be found elsewhere. Each part of the pencil, as simple as those parts are, stimulates a different sense. The wood smells of the tree it came from, the graphite feels a certain way to write with, the eraser uses friction and heat to remove the marks, and the whole thing can disappear after a finite number of words and a quick spin in a pencil sharpener. A combination of each action creates a soundtrack unique to that pencil. The interaction is purely physical and completely connected to the thoughts and ideas in the user's mind. A person is completely free to use their pencil in any way possible. After all, it's erasable." So I'd like to ask you, from that passage, which I loved, it's one I bookmarked, is it that the pencil itself is romantic, or is it the people who have become synonymous with it, like Hemingway, Fitzgerald, Thoreau, are they the ones who make it romantic?
That's a good question. I think it's a kind of a combination of both, to be honest. The thing that I love about the pencil, probably more than anything else, is the stories that come with it. All these legends of what people use them for and how all these people kind of work together to make it the way that it is. And I think that those things kind of combined, kind of romanticize it, but even just as an object, like it's such a simple object, and I think it's really easy to romanticize. Like it's just even like its design and function based around the fact that it just simply is what it is, and simply exists to serve a purpose, and that's it.
Well, I mean, it's both timeless, and it's also very much a product of a specific time period or multiple time periods.
Yeah.
We all know what a pencil looks like now, but I'm wondering, how has it evolved since the 16th century?
It's definitely evolved a lot since the 16th century. It hasn't evolved that much, honestly, though, since the 1800s. It's kind of been the same. Once they figured it out, they figured it out, and that was it. Took a long time to get there, but it's amazing that it's a perfect object. There's not really much that you can do to it to make it better. Actually, I can't think of anything. And I think that maybe is the most romantic thing about it. It's perfect just the way it is. There's no type of technology or anything that can make it better than what it already is and what it has been for like almost 200 years.
It's interesting because you have this a section on World's Fairs, and the pencil at the time, you're talking like, I think 1889, 1890, somewhere around there. Mm-hmm. You've got these World's Fairs where people are demonstrating things like the moving picture for the first time, or dishwashers, and the pencil, which, you know, as we've said, is this ubiquitous object now, was also technology that was being showed off and, I guess, exhibited as the pinnacle of modern technology to a point. And I'm curious how that even came to be. What was it about the pencil at the time that was so modern around the late 1800s, if it had been already evolving over the last several hundred years?
It is kind of curious that they would show a pencil at the World's Fair where all these other really, really, really remarkable, groundbreaking, history-making things were happening. But that was around the period of time when, I mean, the pencil had been around for a while. They'd figured it out already. Like, there are many companies making them, especially in Europe, even in the US. But that was kind of the period of time when these companies started realizing, like, okay, like, we figured this out now. Now let's find a way to market it and make it different, or make it more special, or make it better quality. And so that's, well, I mean, that World's Fair in Paris was when the first painted pencil made its debut, which was also the first yellow pencil. It was also dipped in gold and was very expensive and came in like a really amazing tin. This was the Kohinoor 1500, which still exists today and is kind of credited for the whole like yellow pencil thing. And that was around the time when they for a lot of these European companies especially first started making pencils of different grades, where they were starting to come up with a system to mark whether they were hard or soft, and they made a really wide range so that people could use them for different things. And so that was around the time when people started marketing it as not just like an essential object, but as a desirable object.
While there were other inventors and pencil makers like Staedtler and Faber, you devote an entire chapter to Joseph Dixon, the creator of the iconic Dixon Ticonderoga, which is a staple of every back-to-school list. And he's someone who came late to the pencil game. So I'm curious, what made his contributions to pencil history so important?
Joseph Dixon was a really interesting character because he was so persistent. He was an inventor and made a lot of different things. And then once he started to get to know graphite, he started making crucibles out of it. And that's what he originally was most known for. But his real passion was trying to figure out how to make a pencil. And that's something that kind of happened on the side and knew graphite really, really well as a mineral. But his kind of all along, his real passion was trying to figure out how to make a really great pencil. And he was not good at it. He tried many, many times. He had a room in his house where he would just like sit there at night at home trying to figure out how to make a pencil. And this was all kind of around the time when, like, in the U.S., especially in Europe, they figured it out. Nicola Conte had kind of like found a way to make a pencil the way that we know it now with like a clay and graphite core that's then fired like ceramics. But in the U.S., people hadn't really figured it out yet. The Thoreaus were almost there. Like, they were probably the closest to knowing how to make it that way. But this was the 1800s. Like, news didn't travel. And so, and it was also really top secret. And so Joseph Dixon was over there, like, just trying to make a pencil. And that was his main passion. And for decades, he tried and just couldn't do it. And he couldn't get anyone to buy them. And nobody was really interested because he was making money doing all these other things. And so when he opened his factory in Jersey City, where he was making his crucibles under the name Joseph Dixon Crucible Company, he built it so that like there was half of the factory that was for the crucibles and the other half for the pencils. And for a really long time, his pencils weren't even making money. He just subsidized it with the Crucible Company and did it because it's what he really wanted to do. And it wasn't really, honestly, until after he died that they started making a lot of pencils. And towards the end of his life, that's when they started to develop a lot of machinery that made it much faster, much easier to make pencils. And so he was kind of at the forefront of that and got a hold of a lot of this machinery and developed a lot of it himself. So when he could start making like humongous quantities of it, that's when he started making money. But Ticonderoga only really became a name like really after he died. And it's just become ubiquitous with the American yellow pencil because it's the one that's just simply been like the most mass produced for as long as that the idea of an American yellow pencil has been around.
Well, what fascinated me about Dixon was he's also responsible for the way modern currency is printed in a way that can't easily be counterfeited. Yet we only remember him because of the pencil. Why do you think that is?
Well, his name is still on them. I don't know. I mean, because he did all these other really amazing things, and he was very well known at the time for all these other things he was doing. Nobody cared about his pencils, and I think unless you dig really deep into history books, you wouldn't know his name for anything else because there's still a brand in 2017 with his name on it,
right?
Which is kind of crazy. There aren't many of those left. Almost no pencil companies from that era still exist in the U.S. It's funny. I'm surprised that there's not more about that. And also the Dixon Ticonderoga Company, they don't make any of their products in the U.S. anymore, and they've been bought and sold so many times. Like I just think that a lot of that has been lost, and I wish that they did a better job of kind of sharing their history and sharing these stories about this amazing person who developed their pencils, but that's not, doesn't seem like something that they're terribly interested in.
You had mentioned that he wasn't very good at it when he first started, Dixon. And even reading the book, you realize that the creation of the pencil took some time because it required, you know, it was done by cabinet makers originally, and now it requires these big hulking machines to churn these out. What drew people to making a pencil in the first place if it was so cumbersome and prohibitive to do so, unless you were a skilled tradesman or craftsman?
Yeah, I think a lot of these, especially in Germany, a lot of these cabinet makers who were making them in the beginning were making them just because they were so much easier to use and so much more useful than a lot of the other writing instruments that were around at the time. It was pretty much just fountain pens, and it was just too fussy. Whereas a pencil, you can carry it. All you have to do is have like that and maybe a knife to sharpen it with, and that's all you need. You don't have to worry about it spilling or breaking or like running out of ink. It was just a much, much, much easier way to write. And once they kind of figured out very early on that it was erasable, it became really popular with like cabinet makers or with artists. And so it was, in the beginning, it wasn't really even a writing tool. It was mostly a tool that was used by craftsmen and artists. So I don't know. I don't even know the answer to that, honestly, because it was so hard to make. Every single part of the pencil was made by hand, and it was right. Very, very challenging, and they were very expensive, but they kept doing it. I mean, it definitely wasn't until the Industrial Revolution that they really, really figured it out and that they became like a mass marketed object. But for a while, they were just kind of this handmade commodity that you'd buy on the streets or at a market or like from your local general store. They usually sold them there on consignment even, because they just weren't sold often enough to even like provide a reason to come up with a way to make them faster and better.
And it was the first truly portable writing instrument. You didn't need to carry ink with you. You didn't need to take care of it in any real way. Like you said, just a knife, and then later on, you know, a portable sharpener. How did it change communication?
Well, the pencil created a lot of opportunities to write in places where it may have been inconvenient otherwise, or especially during World War I. That was kind of a game changer because that was before the ballpoint pen was invented. So most of these generals in the war and most of these even like soldiers on the front line, like if they had a writing instrument on them, it was 100% going to be a pencil, quite often even an indelible pencil. A lot of wartime documents were written and signed in indelible pencil because it was by far the easiest permanent portable writing instrument. They just didn't even bother with pens in a lot of situations. But yeah, I think that was kind of a game changer. And at the time when the pencil was invented, the only thing that one could really compare it to was a pen. Mm-hmm. And so I mean, I kind of consider it like the first like truly universally useful communication technology, because of its ease of use, because of its portability, because it was more expensive, less expensive than any other writing instruments around at the time, even apart from the fact that it had to be completely handmade. I mean, everything was handmade, so everything was more valuable, I guess, than it would be today. It was truly the first easy communication technology.
And you had mentioned World War I, but I know World War II also had a profound influence on the evolution of the pencil.
Yeah, in a really different way, because during World War II, there were a lot more shortages in materials to actually make the pencils with. So that's what really kind of forced a lot of these pencil companies to come up with better ways of making their things and more efficient ways of making them, because there was such a high demand. So they had to find a way to make them cheaper and make them better and make them faster and also comply with all of the import and export laws that were enacted at the time, and also to deal with these shortages, which mainly the problem was metal. They couldn't make ferrules to put on the pencils, so those were made out of plastic or paper instead, which I believe it was the American Lead Pencil Company who came up with that idea. Before the war even started, they were kind of anticipating another war and kind of foresaw this problem happening, and so they came up with a solution before the war even started.
And I think Europe just decided not to put anything, right? They either left it dipped or open on the end.
Yeah. I mean, the ferrule was never really a thing in Europe anyway. Even to this day, it's easier to find a pencil without a ferrule than one with one. It just never caught on. And that's a question I get all the time. And I truly don't know an answer. I don't know that anybody does. It's just a thing that started in the U.S. and just never caught on anywhere else.
And since we're on the topic of different countries and the way they view the pencil was a political object as well, right?
Yeah, pencils kind of, a lot of these pencil brands, especially in the beginning, for besides Germany and the U.S., most other countries who were making pencils only had like their one brand. So a lot of them did like really nationalist advertising even, that like pencils from their country are better because of X, Y, and Z. Like the advertising got a little crazy for a while, like probably through the middle of the 20th century. It became an issue, especially with Japanese pencils, because in Japan they were making a lot of knockoffs of American pencils and then exporting them here, and they were selling them cheaper. And so a lot of shops were buying them, often not really knowing that they were fake. That was a big problem for a while. That was kind of maybe like the first controversy in the American pencil industry in like the late 1800s and early 1900s, were all of these like knockoff Japanese pencils. And so the U.S. made a lot of laws about importing pencils from especially Japan. And a lot of rules about how pencils had to be priced a certain way. And a lot of other countries did a similar thing where, like, if you were going to call it like a yellow number two pencil, it had to be this exact price. The ferrule had to look a certain way. The eraser sometimes even had to be like a specific color. There was a lot going on there with the standards from pencil manufacturer.
I thought that was interesting about the American standards they tried to enact on pencil manufacturers. And I think you say the pencil manufacturers basically ignored them because there was no cost efficient way to do half the things they wanted to do. And so they basically said, we're just going to make our pencils. And that's what it is.
Yeah. Yeah. It didn't last long. That's for sure. But that was a hard time for the pencil industry, because that's when these factories started getting really efficient, especially the bigger ones. And then there became this huge gap between they call them the big four, like the four biggest pencil companies in America. There became this huge gap between them and all these like little guys. And so that was their attempt to kind of like put everybody on an equal playing field. And these bigger pencil companies just weren't into it, and these smaller ones just couldn't afford to do a lot of the things that they were going to have to do to follow the rules.
Today's episode is brought to you by Nocht Sound Engineering. Nocht helps you record, edit, and produce great podcasts, streamlining the process so you can deliver high-quality shows to your audience. Whether you just need to trim the ums and you knows, or you're looking to set up the perfect recording rig, Nocht has it all covered. Speaking of, Nocht makes every episode of this podcast sound terrific. Consider this more than just an advertisement, consider it an endorsement. So if you're looking to bring your podcast to the next level, contact Nocht Sound Engineering today at nochtsound.com. That's nachtsound.com. Nocht, more than a stack of tracks. Yeah, I see a lot of similarities in publishing and pencil creation, and I didn't realize there was so much drama. I mean, at some point, it even felt like a Regency drama. You've got these warring families, and it was in publishing. They're like the big six, and now it's the big five, and it was like Penguin and Random House, which are now one thing, and all the a couple of different companies, and they just buy up the little ones where they can, or they run them out of business. And it was interesting to see the pencil industry function very much the same way. I didn't realize there was so much history and drama behind the simple little object.
Oh yeah, so much drama, so much family drama too.
Well, the Faber story really stood out to me, the way they had started. And for anyone who isn't familiar, you've probably seen Faber Castell in like a Michaels or a Hobby Lobby or something, the drawing pencils. But the Faber family started out making pencils in Europe, and then I think it's the grandson who went to America and started up a completely separate Faber company to make pencils.
Yeah, and that wasn't even his intention to begin with. It was supposed to be kind of like a business opportunity to come to the U.S. and set up Faber-Castell in the U.S. And then he kind of just like ditched that idea and went off on his own and started his own company. And the Johann Faber did the same thing. It was a lot, especially at the time it wasn't called Faber-Castell yet. They called it A.W. Faber. Mm-hmm. And at the time, like, they were even like publishing advertisements about like how their consumers shouldn't accept any other pencil brand with the name Faber that wasn't A.W. Faber. And they got really catty about it. They pretty much just like excommunicated this entire like branch of their family, who all kind of like ditched their business and came to the U.S. And they started up a very successful empire here that existed for a long time. They made some amazing products and kind of had like a little bit of like a compound on Staten Island. There's still stuff named after them over there.
There's also, since this is a book podcast, it would be wrong of me not to mention Henry David Thoreau, who wrote Walden, but he was also a very big part of pencil history. How did he contribute?
Henry David Thoreau's father was one of the very, very first pencil makers in the U.S. I consider him to be the first pencil maker in the U.S. He was certainly the most serious of the original pencil makers. And he made pencils in Concord, Massachusetts. And his son, long before he became a writer and before he even like went to school, he helped his father make the pencils. And his dad didn't really seem that interested in like making them better or just doing things differently or coming up with ways to make them different from other pencils that were available in the Boston region at the time. He just simply made a pencil and that was it. That's all he was interested in doing. And his pencils were good too. They were definitely the better of the pencils available in that era before all these big companies existed. But Henry David Thoreau actually contributed a lot to his family pencil business because unlike his father, he was very interested in figuring out what they were doing in Europe and figuring out how to make their pencils the best ones in the U.S. And so he kind of like in early in his adulthood, he went to school and then he came back and did the pencil thing for a while. And then he left. He went to Walden Pond. He came back and kind of did it for a while again. And then he started writing more, and his dad died and he inherited the business. And then he started just selling graphite and not even making pencils anymore. And then it just kind of fizzled out. But a lot of the innovations with early American pencils were actually Henry David Thoreau. Like he's credited with being the first American to figure out the Conté method of making a pencil, or at least something very similar. It wasn't quite the same. Apparently he read something that kind of hinted at that in an encyclopedia and kind of figured it out from there. And he also is credited with coming up with the grading scale that we know in the U.S., the 1, 2, 3, and 4 system. That was allegedly his idea, though there's not really a lot of documentation on any of this. So there's no way to be 100% sure about most of these pencil stories. Most of them are just quite simply stories that have been told for over a century.
It's kind of interesting that the tool that has become synonymous with ultimate in portable communication, there's very little communicated about its creation, its origins. I noticed towards the end of the book, it delves a little more into memoir, but in your research of the book, there was very little for you to use, and even more so for Petrosky, who wrote his book on the pencil in 1990, there was so little to work with, and I'm curious on why that might be.
Yeah, it's really strange. It was really challenging to track down a lot of things there were, and in the book, I try to make it very clear that like some of this stuff, I'm just choosing which stories I've chosen to believe based on what I know, and this is what I'm relaying. But there are two stories for pretty much everything regarding pencil history, and very little of it is documented as fact. And I don't know why. I think because it's not so cut and dry with the pencil. It's not like it was invented by like this person on this date, and then like it kind of evolved from there. It was kind of a worldwide collaborative effort to make this object. And so I think all these tiny parts of it weren't documented because I would think that maybe at the time they just didn't think it was important. They didn't really think about the fact that all these little things together are going to add up to this like one wonderful thing. And so a lot of it's just impossible to confirm. It's really hard to fact check a book when a lot of it's just not fact checkable. It's impossible. But yeah, there's a lot in archives, a lot of old journals about writing instruments and about stationery, even like journals about writing have a lot of information. There are a lot of old catalogs. The old catalogs are really, really useful. A lot of the old advertisements too.
I'd like to talk about the writing of the book. And one thing I noticed, and you're sort of living the dream here, you were asked to write this book.
Yes, I was.
How did that happen?
Well, I mean, it's a thing I always wanted to do, but I thought like, oh, I'm not qualified to do something like this quite yet. And then, I got an email from the creative director, of the publisher, and he just wanted to ask if we could schedule a phone call to talk about doing something together. And I was like, okay, cool. I'd just been in one of their books. They did a book called The Shopkeepers, where they did really beautiful, mostly photographs and like very short interviews with shopkeepers from all over the world. And so I was kind of on their radar because of that. And they just emailed me and they were like, hey, do you want to do this? And I said, yes. And we kind of went from there. It all happened very fast.
Where do you begin your research for a book like this?
Well, I reread The Pencil by Henry Petrosky because that's really the only thing that exists that is written pencil history. It definitely started there. And then, I mean, it was hard because we weren't trying to do what Henry Petrosky already did. His book is amazing. It's very dense. It's really hard to read if you're not super interested in it because it's just so much detailed information. Yeah, we were trying to do something that was a little bit more about the people and a little bit more about the stories than about like telling everything about the invention of an object. And so I kind of took it on by section. I reread The Pencil and then we kind of figured out like which sections were important and like which ones were going to be like the biggest and which ones were going to be carried through the book more, I guess, and which things I wanted to focus on and kind of what the voice would be. And then from there, I think I had to like just separate everything and tackle one tiny thing at a time because it was just too much to just kind of like treat it as like one big research project.
How did you organize everything? Did you like carry a big file folder around or was it mostly digital?
It was kind of half and half. I read a lot of books and just like took notes inside the books that I then transferred to a notebook, but I when I first signed the contract for this thing, I thought like, okay, well, of course I run a pencil shop. I sell stationery. The most important thing to me up front was what am I going to write this with and what am I going to write it on? And so I bought myself this like leather portfolio thing that has like folders in it. It has little slots to keep all your pens and pencils, and it has like a place to put like a really big A4 spiral bound notebook. And so I bought myself like this fancy portfolio thing, and I just crammed everything I could in there and just carried it around with me for 4 months. Wow. But I tried to write everything, but write it out in hand, like in pencil. And quite honestly, I didn't really do like full drafts that way. I took pages and pages of notes and made sure to do them all chronologically. And then I do like an edited version of all the notes after that. And then I would start writing from there, kind of in the notebook and on the computer.
Were there any preconceived notions about the pencil you thought you had known that were sort of upended during the research process?
You know, I don't know that there were. I kind of vaguely knew a little bit about everything. I didn't understand at all like the extent of the family drama with the Faber family. I actually even made like an ancestry.com account like because I was trying to figure out even what their family tree looked like because it was so confusing at one point. And even so, I still couldn't really figure it out. It was very challenging. But a lot of the European pencil history I didn't really know so much about because I'm mostly interested in the American pencil industry. I think there's a lot more there. It took a lot more to get it to where it became eventually. It became a humongous industry, probably even bigger than the European pencil industry at one point. And I think that was probably the thing I wanted to focus on more. So when I realized like, okay, like I can't just write about the American pencil industry, I'm going to have to learn all this stuff about everyone else too. That was challenging. Or even like the Japanese stuff, like the Japanese pencil history was very, very difficult to find because it's all newer history, but it's not really documented either. Or it's in Japanese.
As you were saying, the pencil's history has been captured in Henry Petrosky's book. And it seemed one thing that made your book stand out was that in reading it, it felt as much history as it was memoir for you. And I'm wondering how you decided to tackle it from that approach.
I don't even know that that was a conscious decision. I think that just kind of happened. I don't really consider myself a writer. I have written things in the past, and it's something that I'm interested in, that I feel like I'm okay at doing. So, I mean, when I wrote it, I basically approached it from the mindset, like, I am basically putting on paper the stuff that I talk about in my shop all day. Because I'm always in there just like repeat, like just telling the same like 40 or not even that many, probably like 30 stories to customers all the time. And I'm telling it from my perspective and a kind of involving my personal experience with these things. And so I kind of treated it like that I was just basically like organizing and expanding on the stories that I'm already telling like strangers and friends and random people every single day.
Did you ever worry about stepping on Petrosky's toes while you were writing the book or sort of retreading already traveled ground?
Oh, completely. Yeah. I've never spoken to him before. Actually, I'm really scared that he hates me. I keep thinking like, oh, I need to just like send him a copy and be like, oh, like, here you go. Like, I wrote this. I really hope that you don't think that I'm trying to encroach on your territory. But I mean, his book was also written in 1990. It was written a long time ago, and a lot of things have kind of happened since then. And a lot, I mean, we have the internet now. That's a big thing. So like a lot of this stuff is a little easier to research. So there's more that can be uncovered, but I was very conscious of that the entire time. And I really tried to write it in a different style and share things that maybe he hadn't shared to a great extent. Because his book really covers so much ground. Like, it's like five times what my book covers. And so, yeah, I don't know. That worries me a little bit. I hope he doesn't hate me.
Well, as you said, the pencil really hasn't changed since the middle of the 20th century. I mean, we've reached a point where it's not like you were writing a book about Apple in the 1980s, Apple in 2003, and then Apple now, where they could really be three separate books about three separate companies, to be honest. Now, you know, what you would think what's been said has been said already, but obviously that's not the case. There is quite a bit. And I didn't read Petrosky's book, but I'm not sure how deep into the international pencil market he really dipped.
Yeah, I mean, apart from the very early history with the Fabers and the Staedtlers, he doesn't really write much about the international pencil industry. And I think too, like, it's the pencil may not have changed, but the context in which the pencil exists has changed drastically since 1990. The same goes for any analog tool. It's quite simply no longer an essential object the way that it was before the internet. And so I'm hoping that as like a 20, oh, I guess at the time, yeah, 25 year old writing about a really old, analog tool from the context of like being a child of the internet generation, I think that probably on its own provides a little bit of a different voice about the same thing.
I'd like to talk about that because I'd like to know why do you think the pencil, which it's an object that is not easy to produce, requires you to carry extra hardware in order to use it, and yet it has endured for hundreds of years and doesn't seem to be going away anytime soon. Why do you think that is?
I think there are a lot of reasons. Well, I think the one reason is that there are still things that are better done with a pencil. It's a tool that artists will always use. Mm-hmm. You can't really do what you do with a pencil on a piece of paper, on a canvas, the way that you can. Like, well, I mean, yeah, you can't do that on a computer. You'll never be able to. And even just as like a learning tool, like in school, I mean, a lot of schools use computers and iPads now, but if you're in school and you're going to write something down by hand, it's going to be in a pencil. There's just quite simply no other way. Even for just regular users and for writers and for illustrators and for a lot of these, for most of us who have jobs and who live lives where we could easily choose one or the other. We could do everything on a computer if we wanted to, but we choose not to sometimes. And I think a lot of that has to do with like the craving for something tactile, and it has to do with like wanting to use something that's nostalgic. I think it's about wanting to have a physical connection with the work that you're doing through through an object that's not mm-hmm. a keyboard. And I think it's better in a lot of ways. I mean, when you're writing something or taking notes in school, like there's so many studies and research reports that prove that you have a better ability to retain information if you're writing it down instead of typing it. There are a lot of reasons. And I think it's because it's less of a necessity, but I think that it's almost become, well, I hate the word novelty. I think it's almost become a novelty in the sense that it's not necessarily chosen because of the function that it performs, but the way that it performs it.
Right. And you say in the book, you mentioned that some people think your shop is twee or hipster. And I can see why they would think that. I mean, you know, if anyone's familiar with New York, it's, you know, if you're going to have a boutique niche shop, you do it in New York City, or you do it in Portland, or you do it in Austin. But, you know, you do it in a place where you have this melting pot of tastes and cultures. But the difference is, it's not like you started up a coffee shop because a coffee shop is the trendy thing to do. To be honest, the idea of starting a pencil shop in the middle of a digital universe and in the middle of one of the most expensive cities in the world sounds a little insane. And it's fantastic that you've been able to thrive. My dream to open up an independent bookshop is a little crazy, considering that, you know, Barnes & Noble is on its way out the door and Amazon's popping up bookshops now. So, you know, it's great that you're able to succeed, but the one thing that really helps stand you out and gives it that authentic feel is that you love what you're selling. It's clear that you absolutely adore the products you carry and you know a lot about them, and you didn't do it to be trendy. You did it because this is the thing I know and I'm good at and I want to share it with everyone else.
Yeah, that's really the only reason why I did it, to be honest. And I was so naive going into it. I didn't even think about like anything else. But it's in retrospect, when you put it that way, it sounds really insane. Had I thought to do something like that now, if I hadn't done it sooner, I don't know that I would have had the guts to do it. But it's hard opening a specialty shop here because people just assume that specialty shops are disappearing because rent's too expensive or because people buy everything on Amazon. But I think that makes people want them more. I think that mm-hmm. makes them more interesting. Like when there is a specialty shop that does still exist and there's a reason why, like then at least now I feel like we have better quality specialty shops because there's a reason why the ones that are still around exist. Right. And it's because they're really good at what they do.
I had talked about this a little bit with David Sacks, who wrote The Revenge of Analog. And there's this resurgence of specialty analog shops, and even more than shops, you've got like board game cafes where you can go in and get a cup of coffee and play Chutes and Ladders with someone, or there's still vinyl shops kicking around, new and used. Vinyl itself has been making a huge comeback in big stores like Urban Outfitters, Barnes & Noble. So there is this resurgence of analog tools, and a lot of it is being propelled by young people.
I don't really even know why it is. I think it's just because people we're so involved with being on our phones all day and like having to be plugged in all the time. I think that like that craving for something simpler is a very real thing that most people feel, especially younger people who like this is all we've known. I mean, well, I guess especially like the generation like slightly younger than me. I mean, we got a computer in my house when I was in third grade. That was our first computer. But that's all we've ever known. We've never known anything different. And so to know that there are things like typewriters that exist and things like pencils and things like record players. And that's And that's just quite simply an easy, really pleasant way to do the same thing that we normally do on a computer. Like that's, yeah, it makes it desirable.
You're a podcaster and blogger. You need an analytics and hosting platform that provides you with the right tools to make your job easier, so you can get back to doing what you do best, creating stuff. FeedPress is a delightfully intuitive RSS analytics and podcast hosting platform with accurate analytics for RSS feeds and email newsletters. Bloggers and podcasters tap into RSS subscriber, geolocation, podcast download, and link tracking metrics, which come standard on all plans. In a matter of minutes, podcasters can create a feed and publish to iTunes, add your show notes, artwork, and drag and drop an MP3 into the editor to go live. Every podcast plan comes with 400 megabytes of file storage that's unmetered. This means you won't have to worry about running out of storage for long episodes or getting dinged for a sudden spike in download traffic when your podcast becomes an overnight success. FeedPress offers an automatic feed burner migration tool so you can make that transition with ease. Your feeds and subscriber data will be moved into your FeedPress account. And if you're currently hosting a podcast elsewhere, they can help you migrate your feeds and media files over so that your listeners don't notice you've changed anything. Support is responsive and available 7 days a week via feed.press/contact. Sign up today and try FeedPress on a 14-day commitment-free trial at feed.press/covered. Use promo code COVERED during checkout to get 10% off your first year.
I had been reading, I don't know if you're familiar with Manoush Zomorodi and her podcast Note to Self.
No.
So she's it's produced by WNYC, and it's all about the human relation to technology and how it's affecting our lives. And she has a book out, and I've been trying to schedule an interview with her through her publicist. It's called Bored and Brilliant, and it's based on a week-long series of exercises she did where each day she asked the audience to do something related to usually the phone. So, for example, one day you would delete the app that you open the most, the one that's clogging up all your time. And then the next day she would ask, if you're a habitual picture taker of your food or your surroundings, don't take any pictures that day. Just as a way to make you think about how you use your phone, how it affects your life. And one thing I keep coming back to, because I hear people ask this question, you know, why do you think there's such a resurgence in analog tools and the analog lifestyle? And it only struck me a couple days ago, I think the biggest thing is anxiety. I think there is a big anxiety with technology. It's part of the reason I love paper books. I'm not waiting for a notification to come in. I'm not waiting to be disturbed by something beeping or blinking. And I feel the same way when I pick up a pencil or a pen and use a notebook. It's just me and the object, and there's nothing else to worry about. And I feel like that's been the missing link that I don't think anyone's really tapped into, that the anxiety is a big proponent of lowering the effects of digital technology on our lives and going back to a simpler, more analog lifestyle.
That is so true. That's completely true. Yeah, that's a great revelation to have. I never really thought about it that way before. Oh, that's really wonderful. That's so true. I mean, I'm a very anxious person. I get stressed out by everything. Everything gives me anxiety. So I think that's definitely a reason why I prefer to do things the easy, well, I guess the simple way, why right. I prefer to keep a paper planner and not have it on my phone. Because the idea of going on my phone and having to like press 5 buttons to figure out what I'm doing on a single day, like, is really stressful to me.
Right. The only time I've ever had anxiety with analog tools is when the delivery guy comes and I have to sign the receipt and he didn't bring a pen and I have nothing to sign it with.
Yeah.
So I'd like to ask you now, do you see the pencil evolving any further than it has already?
That's a good question. I don't think that the pencil can evolve much more than it has already. And I think that the things that could be done to make it better are already being done if they haven't been done already. In Japan, there's a lot still going into making better pencils using different types of waxes and polymers to make them better. A lot of these smaller companies, a lot of these brands that don't make their pencils in China or Mexico are still improving their machinery to make the pencils more consistent, more just higher quality even. I don't know. I think a lot about pencils that I wish existed that don't already exist. And I have a hard time even coming up with anything, but most of the things that I think of are actually pencils that have existed in the past that, but don't anymore because there just aren't the machines to make them anymore. Like pencils of different sizes, pencils only really come in like two sizes, maybe three different diameters. But there used to be all these great, like tiny pencils that were bridge pencils that were so much easier to like slip into like the little loop that you have, like sometimes on a notebook or, and they were really great, or they had different colors on both sides for different reasons. And we don't have a use for those anymore for the most part. So they just don't exist. Or a lot of these like really fancy ferrules that used to exist when they used to make them out of brass instead of aluminum. Were amazing.
I love the idea of people advertising with the bullet pencils. I thought that was such a cool idea.
Truly, like the only way that anybody's really innovating a pencil anymore is by making them more eco-friendly. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of that, like a lot, like there are the Sprout pencils, and there's one that we saw just the other day that I think is made in Croatia that is like entirely recyclable. And made entirely out of recycled materials.
I bought one at your shop that's made of old newspapers. And I love the way when it sharpens, I love the way the shavings come out.
Yeah, it's really fun. They all kind of like flake apart.
Yeah.
That's a really fun one. It looks like sedimentary rock. I love it. Mm-hmm. But yeah, a lot of them are just becoming more sustainable, or they're trying to find. I mean, there's some really bad ones. There's this pencil that I really don't like that is made out of, I think it's made in Italy, and it's made out of... it's made out of recycled graphite, actually, but like the whole thing is black and it's very heavy and it just doesn't write dark enough. It's like the whole thing is made out of recycled materials, and there's a lot of that happening, and some of it isn't being done very well. But there's a fair amount of innovation in that department. No one's done it perfectly, but it would be really cool to see like a super recyclable pencil. I just don't know that it could exist and be as good as a regular one. Or even like, I just think a lot of things about the design of it, well, really mostly just ferrules. Like you can't really change anything of the pencil itself, but a lot of the erasers could be better. Mm. If you've ever noticed, like the erasers that come on the end of a pencil are never as good as an eraser that you would buy on its own.
Right.
Because a lot of these companies just don't use their good erasers for that. Like even the Japanese ones, like they're not, Tombow's not going to like make a pencil or an eraser to go on the end of a pencil out of like a mono eraser when they only have like one product that even has an eraser on the end. So it's kind of a stupid thing that people get really annoyed about, the quality of the erasers.
You had gone on the Erasable podcast and, they are, and I'm sure I have some listeners from Erasable, but for anyone who doesn't know, it's a podcast about pencils, which I think is also helping push the pencil, I don't want to say agenda, but it's, you know, to get pencils out there into to a younger audience and maybe people who hadn't thought about them before, you know, it brings it to the forefront. And, you know, there's more than just the Ticonderoga in the Staples aisle. There's a whole world of pencils out there. But when you were on, I know you had been asked who you thought the audience for the book would be when you were writing it. But what I'd like to know is, how do you get people who don't think about the pencil? How do you get people who see a pencil on a desk and they don't care either way if it's a Blackwing or if it's a Ticonderoga or if it's the cheap one you get in the gift shop? How do you get them to care about it?
Well, I give them some really amazing pencils to try. I think that's really the only way to really get it is to actually use them. It's pretty easy, honestly. I mean, if we're talking about like people who just don't get pencils at all, it's a little trickier with the book. And that's why, I mean, it helps that it's a really pretty book. It has a lot of illustrations in it. It is in a lot of museum bookshops.
As well, it should be. It is a work of art. It is It's really stunning.
Yeah, so they did a really great job. I can't take credit for any of that. That was all them. I just wrote the words, but it's a beautiful book, and it was published by a publisher who does primarily art and design books. This was their first text-based book that they've ever done. Mm-hmm. And so I think that gives it a different kind of spin, because it's not being like marketed as a history book. It's being marketed as like a design book that's about the history of a design object, basically.
It's very meta.
yeah, it totally is. But I think that kind of creates, like, on its own, kind of creates a different audience. It's not the kind of book that you would carry in your backpack and read while you're on the subway. And I had that in mind while writing it, that kind of it's broken up into sections, and like there's a section about a bunch of different families, and it's not like you're reading straight through. It's kind of all like separate stories that fit together. And so we wrote it so that you could like sit down at your couch and read like one section of it, and then be done with it for a little bit. And then maybe come back and read another section until you've read the whole thing. I think, if you're interested in history, like, that's mostly what it is. That's an easy selling point. But, the story about these things is, that's what I use to sell things in my shop to begin with. So a lot of these people who are really skeptical, like, that's what I kind of try to enforce. I'm like, oh, you think it's just a pencil? Let me prove to you that it's a million other things for a million other reasons. And, I think there's always a way. I think a lot of people just don't know. And so that's why I have the job I have. It's my job to expose people to great pencils and to the stories about them, and convince them that, like, oh, maybe you should take a second look, because this thing is actually really interesting as a historic object and as a useful object.
Oh, absolutely. And it's funny, I bought from your store one of those jumbo train pencils, the fat one with the choo-choo on the side of it.
Yeah.
And I bought it for my son, because he's three and he's learning to form letters and everything. And he absolutely adores that pencil. And if I can foster that love of writing objects in him at this age, then I have nowhere to go but up with him.
Definitely. You're doing a good job already.
My wallet's going to hurt when he discovers Blackwing. You can hire him now. He will talk anyone's ear off about trains and train pencils. So he will sell all of your train pencils.
That's funny. I'll take him.
I'll have to bring him by. Speaking of your shop, you had closed down the Forsyth Street shop for a while. I don't know if you want to go into why that had happened, but I know you're opening up a brand new store on Orchard Street.
Yeah, it's all exciting stuff that kind of happened in a really terrible way. We are in the middle of a nasty landlord dispute over a mold problem. Ugh. That's going to go on for a while longer. But to be honest, we were kind of outgrowing that space. When I first started the shop, I guess like 2.5 years ago, it was just me, and the shop is small. It's 200 square feet. I did everything from there. I shipped and fulfilled all the online orders. Every single thing happened there. Mm-hmm. And we grew a lot faster than I ever had planned for. And so eventually we got another storefront down the street to use as a fulfillment center and office. And then by the time all this drama went down, it was kind of honestly time to move on to a bigger space anyway. It really happened at a good time. So we're moving into a bigger shop on my favorite block in the neighborhood. I'm so excited. There are a lot of great restaurants over there. And we're starting construction next week. So we'll be open in early October, and we have a lot of really great surprises in store.
How much bigger is the new location?
Well, the shop itself is like 650 square feet, and then there's a really big basement that's finished. So we'll consolidate our two spaces into one and move all of our online fulfillment and subscription box stuff to the basement, and then build a little office in the back of the shop. But we've got some pretty wacky things in store. I think a lot of people are going to be surprised when they see what the new shop is like.
I loved your old shop. I mean, you really couldn't take a bad picture inside that shop. But as you were saying, like, if you got more than two people in there, it felt like a walk-in closet. It just it got very cramped very quickly. And I'm 6'3", so when Andy Welfley and I walked in, it was like you had these two giants in your shop. but it was gorgeous. Shop. Are you still going to have, like, the champagne glasses with the pencils in it and everything?
Yeah, we're keeping all the same furniture, and we're still displaying things more or less the same way. We'll be able to add some furniture. So we're going to have like a sharpening testing station, where all the sharpeners are in one place, and you can try them all out. We'll have a couple new pieces of furniture, and we'll still incorporate the red velvet in somehow. The way that it's set up, we can't really have like a big red velvet curtain across the whole back of the store like we used to. Mm-hmm. But I'm trying to design it so it feels the same way, kind of like wacky modernist schoolhouse is kind of what I always imagined it looking like when I first started dreaming of this. But it's being designed to like feel the same way, also still be very like very photographable. I want people to come in and take pictures and Instagram them, or that visual aspect is very important, but it'll be good. I'm really excited. I just bought a new bench yesterday that I'm really excited about. We're kind of trying to make it a more comfortable, more fun space.
Awesome. I'm very excited. Are you going to do like a big, nice grand opening?
Probably. I don't even know exactly when we'll open. If we stick to our construction schedule, it should be probably like beginning of the second week of October, but we'll probably plan something for later in the month. It's a lot to open a new shop, and we're adding some new staff too. And we're going to have to get used to doing all of our fulfillment in the same space at the same time. I'm a little bit afraid of what the adjustment's going to be like. So I think we'll wait a little bit and see how it goes and then plan something once we're settled.
Excellent. One last question. This is the season of women authors. So I'm only interviewing women for the season, and you are the second. And I was wondering, what books by women authors are you reading right now? Cause I know you've actually on the website, you have sort of a book recommendation blog post going on.
Yeah, Pencil Lady Book Club. We started doing that this summer. We're actually planning another one. Right now I'm not reading any female authors, but my three, like I very strategically planned like my three vacation books this summer. I went on vacation last month, and they were all female authors, and I think I did an excellent job. They were the perfect vacation books. And I'm not really like a beach reads kind of person. That's not really my style of book, but I picked Goodbye Vitamin by Rachel Kong, which is a new one, and it was phenomenal.
I've heard good things about that.
It was great. It first caught my eye because she did a Grub Street diet post on New York Magazine. They do this thing where they like have somebody who's like a figure in, I guess, media or food or... she used to be the editor of a food magazine, so I think that's why she was on here. A lot of times it's just like celebrities where they write about every single thing that they eat for an entire week. It's like a food diary for a week, but they do them with really interesting people. So she did one, and at the bottom they had a little blurb about her new book. So I pre-ordered it and I loved it. And I also read Modern Lovers by Emma Straub, which I had been waiting for. I've been waiting to buy it because I wanted to read it in paperback. I hate lugging around giant hardbacks. I'd rather have a paperback. And that was a really great book. It was kind of devastating, but it was, it was a really different read than what I normally pick up. And I also read Hot Milk by Deborah Levy, which I'll admit I contemplated buying for a very long time and ultimately never did because I had a real prejudice against its cover. It's just like a photographic cover of like an ocean and then like a body of rocks and like a girl just like lying on the rocks. But I have a really big issue with photographic covers that I just can't knock. It's a really stupid problem to have. It really affects my opinions on, well, my first impressions of a book. And so I was just being crazy about not buying this book because I didn't like the cover. And then we played a game at the Strand. I was there with my boyfriend, and he does not like to spend as much time in there as I do. And so often I have a time limit. I'm given like 20 minutes or something, and I have to be done in 20 minutes. But to keep him entertained, I told him like, well, why don't you and I separate, and then you go pick out a book for me that you think I would like based on what you know that I like about books. And so he disappeared for like an hour, and I found him somewhere, and that was the book he'd chosen for me, was Hot Milk. So I read it, and then I felt really terrible about having this like weird hang up about the cover for so long, because it was an amazing book.
You're not the only one. I I judge books by their covers all the time, and it's part of the reason I picked them up in the first place. My first guest of the season, Greer McAllister, she wrote a book called Girl in Disguise about the first female detective in the United States, and the cover is this beautifully illustrated, it's this woman on a train, and it almost looks pulpy to a degree, and I saw the cover and the fonts, and I fell in love with it, and I'm so glad I did, because it's a terrific book.
Yeah, I mean, you have to have a reason to pick up a book in the first place, whether it be the cover that you've heard of it or that it's an author that you already know. Like, it's important. It's important to me that, and a lot of times the books that I love also have great covers because they're all kind of like aligned with the same taste. So it makes sense that a book would have a cover that reflects what the book is. So I don't feel bad about it most of the time.
Okay. And if you like devastating reads, A Little Life by Hanya Yanagihara. Oh, excellent.
I love it.
Oh, you have read it.
I read it when it first came out, and it was in hardback, and I lugged that thing around for like 3 months.
Yep.
And I read it at lunch. I went to the same sushi restaurant that's always empty around the corner from the shop and brought that book with me every single day. I ate so much sushi in that 3 months.
And I know you're in the city. I commute from New Jersey, and I was schlepping that thing on the train every single day in my bag. That and the Goldfinch.
That's the biggest book I think I've ever carried around with me for a long period of time. Because I really do normally wait until the paperback comes out if it's that kind of book, but I just couldn't wait for that one. So I just did it.
Yeah, that one was terrific. That one broke me.
I love devastating books.
Yeah.
I want them to make me cry.
That's great. Well, thank you very much, Caroline, for coming on. This has been wonderful.
Yeah, thank you for having me. This was so much fun.
Where can people find you?
You can find me on Instagram at CW Pencil Enterprise, on Twitter at CW Pencils, on the regular internet at CWPencils.com, and on Facebook, but I don't know how to do that. So good luck.
And you do pop up on occasion in the Erasable podcast community group, which is nice. I'll put a link there as well.
Yeah.
This has been Covered with special guest Caroline Weaver. Links to The Pencil Perfect and all other books discussed will be available in our show notes and on our website at hologramradio.org/covered. I'd like to thank our Patreon patrons, Tim Wassum of the Erasable Podcast, Stuart Lennon, Kyle Wallace, Alex Knight, and Aaron Mankey. If you're able to give a dollar or two an episode to help fund more great interviews like this one today, please consider supporting Covered at patreon.com/covered. In addition to helping me make the show, you'll also gain access to ad-free versions of these episodes, as well as a bonus mini episode at the $5 level. This week's mini episode will not only feature lessons learned by Caroline in publishing The Pencil Perfect, but also her current top 5 pencils. And if you fancy other Hologram Radio shows and would like to drop a few dollars their way, you can support the network as a whole at patreon.com/hologramradio. You can follow me on Twitter at HCMarks and the show at Covered_FM. Thank you to TJ Cosgrove for our beautiful logo and Lorenzo Gudemi for all the hard work he puts into making this show sound fantastic. And as always, thank you again to Feed Press and Noct Sound Engineering for their support of this show. And remember, don't judge a book till it's covered.